Welcome back to Chad and Steve Have a Podcast. One of our favorite people, JJ McCullough, is joining us today to talk about maybe nostalgic toys and games, world leaders, sports balls, shoes on the side of the road, and his quest to save YouTube from Canadian nationalism. In case you haven't seen a JJ video, it's an eclectic mix of pop culture, soft politics, and nostalgia. But no matter what the topic, it's always presented in JJ's usual breezy and bouncy style. And before we begin, I wanted to read the top comment from your latest video about world leaders of the 90s. This guy wrote, "Can't wait for JJ's 2040 retrospective on the wacky leaders of the 2020s. I don't know what the future holds, but I know that JJ will still have great hair." Hey, welcome back.
That's awesome. Thanks so much. I'm happy to be back.
You're one of our favorite people to have on the show.
Aww. Well, this is one of my favorite podcasts to be on, so it's mutual.
I noticed on your Twitter bio, okay, let's just jump right into this because I was wondering. Your Twitter bio starts with Canada's 363rd most popular YouTube. Question one, do you keep this updated in real time? And question two, how closely do you pay attention to things like your standing in the YouTube world?
Yeah, so I do try to keep that updated in real time. Sort of the story behind that is somewhat interesting, though, because as you sort of mentioned, and perhaps we can get into this in more detail later, I have sort of, in my country of Canada, become a bit of the public face of opposition to a piece of legislation that the Justin Trudeau administration is trying to push through in order to regulate YouTube in a kind of more nationalistic direction. And one of the sort of pretenses of this legislation, you know, which is supposed to sort of boost good sort of patriotic Canadian content at the expense of scary and bad foreign content that would sort of erode the national character of the country. Like part of the pretense is that sort of like Canadian YouTubers need government sort of paternal helping hand. And, you know, I testified at the Canadian Parliament some months ago against this legislation. And one of the sort of talking points I had was that to sort of like the lay person, and I think a lot of YouTubers can probably relate to this experience at some level. Like to the lay person, I sometimes probably seem like, oh, I'm very successful. I'm a big successful YouTuber, you know, this kind of thing. But what I wanted to remind the politicians is that actually, as successful as I may seem, you know, on the surface level, you know, as a guy who makes his sort of full-time living just being a professional YouTuber, there's like well over, you know, at the time, like over 400 Canadian YouTubers who are more successful than me. So I just kind of wanted to contextualize my own success for sort of political reasons and make it very clear that like Canada is a country that is home to an enormous number of full-time professional YouTubers who, you know, have subscriber counts in the millions, and that I am actually a rather small fish. And if I can make it work, then, you know, perhaps government's helping hand is not really necessary. The second half of your question, how closely do I keep tabs on all this kind of stuff? I don't know, maybe more. Like, Social Blade is, I think, quite an addicting website,
as I'm sure many of us. So my question is, if I were to go to your computer and go into the web browser bar and just type S with the first
Social Blade. Yes. You are right to assume so. I mean, I guess there's sort of like two metrics that I'm kind of obsessed with. You know, I really want to get to a million subs. You know, I'm at 800 something right now, and obviously like a million is, I think to a lot of YouTubers, and this kind of sounds a little grim to say, perhaps on some level, like to a lot of YouTubers, and maybe I'm in this camp, like a million is like the greatest achievement that we will ever get, you know?
That's it.
You know, like, because it's true. It's like once you pass a million, like you're not going to get the diamond encrusted 10 million one. I mean, like, let alone the ruby one or whatever, right? Like, it's just not that realistic. So like, it is kind of fetishized. And I know that you guys often make the point that, oh, you know, this is a vanity metric and so forth. But, you know, I'm maybe a little bit vain.
But we're all,
you know,
vain.
Right?
We're all vain.
We all are.
So,
yeah, you can't. I mean, I have mine displayed. It's in my office. You know, I'm proud of it. It was a momentous event when I got that. And when I got the 100,000 plaque, too. But it's that duality of, yeah, I know this is kind of ridiculous, but yeah, I kind of like
yeah.
it too.
Yeah, and then so like, and so I'm like very obsessed with like seeing, because I usually get like 1,000 subs a day, And so like, I really want to like make sure that that's continuing to happen because, you know, I've done all of these, I've done like these calculations, you know, I even have like little notes in my notebook where it's like, this probably sounds very obsessive. It's like, you know, by, you know, September 15th, I must have like this many subscribers because the goal is to get to 1 million by 2023. So, you know, that's the other. Yeah. And then the other sort of thing is that, you know, to go back to the first half of this, I kind of would like to crack some sort of elite tier in the Canadian context, because of course Social Blade lets you know where you rank relative to your countrymen, you know, and I feel like I'd like to, you know, crack the top 300, 200, you know, cracking the top 100 Canadian YouTubers is probably not that realistic, but you know, it's some sort of high standing within the status of my own country is something that I would like.
And it's funny because within Canada, I think we have just the right population size where top 100 is such a like top tier thing. I think we're at like 183 or one, because I don't, oh, really? Clearly, really? I don't pay attention to these things either. But yeah, I think we're about half of what your number is. And I remember we just passed Nelly Furtado and it was like,
oh my,
we've been, we're ready to make some moves. And I guess probably because they send out gold played buttons and they made it be a thing very early on, and 1 million subscribers was such a monumental thing that you're absolutely right. We are right now at like 1.9997 or something. So we're right on the brink of, and I was trying to think of like, it's been 1 million since, you know, this plaque was shipped, it's been another 1 million subscribers. And it's just not the same. Yeah, it's disingenuous. Like, mm-hmm. I'm reaching for it to be like, yeah, but it just, I don't know what it is. Are you afraid you're gonna like lose the gusto after you reach that milestone?
Yeah, maybe. But then on the other hand, like, if I was to lose the gusto, and if I was to sort of even like start imagining another career, I feel like I would feel vindicated in doing so, you know, like if I was, because like I've cycled through, you know, I'm not that old, I'm 38, right, but I have feel like I've cycled through several different sort of incarnations of myself to this point. You know, I worked for a time as a professional cartoonist, you know, I worked for a time as a professional journalist, as a television sort of pundit guy, and you know, now I'm in this sort of phase of my life where I'm a YouTuber, and I feel like it would be naive of me sort of looking at my own past to assume that this is what I'm going to do forever, right? So if there is to be sort of any point at which I could even begin, like, you know, the earliest beginnings of the end imaginations, it would probably be after I get 1 million, because then I can say, like, no matter what else I get up to in my life, I can always say that during the phase of my life in which I was a YouTuber, I at least cleared this 1 million subscriber milestone, which at the time was considered a very sort of culturally important thing within that subculture.
Have you always been this way? Like, have you always approached your life that way? Or did you find yourself kind of moving through these phases of your life and that became kind of more familiar, so you started kind of planning for that more?
I think that what I've always found is that one thing sort of leads logically to the other. You know, like when I was a cartoonist, I started getting interested in political cartoons. And then through political cartoons, I started getting interested in political writing. And then when I started doing like political writing, then that sort of led itself into journalism. And then through written journalism, I got into television journalism. And then through television journalism, you know, I talked about this in I think my first appearance on the Chad and Steve podcast. I was working for a television station and that ultimately shut down. And then when the TV station I was working for shut down, you know, my experience being on camera, I feel like led logically into a career of being on camera on the internet, of being on YouTube. So I don't super clearly have a sense of where YouTube sort of success might lead down the line, like what sort of is the next sort of logical phase of that. Honestly, I haven't really sort of thought of that, but you know, I'm not close-minded to it. And again, like I try to have a kind of a sense that, like, you know, what I'm doing now is not the sort of the forever thing, just because, you know, things transition into new things in ways you can't always predict, and sort of connections you make and doors that are opened and you know, new skills that you acquire and new sort of forms of confidence that you gain. Like, again, like, you know, I wouldn't have become a YouTuber if I hadn't already sort of accumulated some sense of confidence that I'm a good on-camera personality and I can speak well, you know, extemporaneously and all these other sort of qualities that matter in sort of the YouTube field. So I don't know, but I try to be open-minded about this.
I was talking to a friend of mine who's been doing YouTube actually 2 years longer than I have. He started in 2006, and he mentioned that, and he's still doing YouTube, is that when this is all said and done, we're going to have an amazing documentation of our lives of this period. I mean, you're looking back, and I can see that in my own videos now. If I look back at something I was shooting in 2009 or 10, and I think, wow, that is so different, that person than this person now. Yeah. I think this is kind of a great time in history where people can regularly do that and see that. I think that when I was growing up, we would, even photographs were not really a common thing the way they're common today. I mean, we had to like actively think about how many shots you had. You know, you get the 12 or the 24 shot roll of film. And I remember my mom saying, don't use them all up at once. You know, be very selective. If we were really like big spenders, you'd get the 36 count roll of film. But, yes, but the photos were all, you know, they were special and not like it is today, where our lives are documented.
Yeah, no, it's very true. I was actually thinking about this the other day because I was at a YouTuber film festival, which we can maybe talk about because that was quite interesting. Yeah. But a number of the YouTubers who were sort of showing their videos, a couple of them had videos that were sort of about their own sort of life journey and their evolution and stuff. And there was a lot of these were, of course, very young people. So they had a lot of, you know, footage of themselves making their own sort of home movies with their digital cameras and stuff like that. And it just kind of it occurred to me just like how little documentation I have of myself as like a teenager or as a youth, right? Like I have a few like blurry photos that my parents took when I was a little kid. And then I was thinking about this, like there's maybe like, you know, three photos that I have access to of me as a teen. Yeah. Like there's this one where like I have dyed hair and I'm giving the peace sign. And like, that's like my stock photo. And I even use this in my videos sometimes when I have to like depict JJ at, you know, 16, you know, that's the one piece of evidence I have of that phase of my life. Whereas the kids today, you know, who are vlogging and making YouTube channels and social media and Instagram, they just have such a thorough documentation of their youth. And I think that's something to envy the youth about.
One of the things that we did ask, and I love asking the question because sometimes it changes, is when someone asks you what you do, what do you say that you do?
Yeah, so I actually feel like I have talked about this on every Chad and Steve episode because it's an interesting one, and it's one that I feel like I have a sort of fun way of sort of framing, which is just the idea that it depends who I'm talking to. Like, it depends who the audience is, because I have this other job at the Washington Post, right? Like, that's sort of like we're talking about before, like sort of remnants of your previous careers sort of like lingering on. Despite the fact that I'm like a full-time YouTuber, I still do write a weekly column on Canadian politics for the Washington Post. So that is very like prestigious in some ways to some people. So when I introduce myself or I'm meeting like older people for whom like legacy journalism is impressive, I always sort of say, I'm a Washington Post columnist.
They're all like, ooh. So,
yes, yes. But it's like, you know, if I'm talking to some cool teens, that would not move them at all, right? So I say, oh, I'm a YouTuber, just like your hero Logan Paul, and they're like, oh my, that's very glamorous, isn't it?
JJ's going to be boxing, you know, next.
No, for sure. So it's and I feel like in the past we've discussed this as well, like, and I hear this from YouTubers too, where, you know, if they're not Washington Post columnists, they sometimes, when they're talking to older people, they sort of lead with things like, well, I make videos or I edit videos or, you know, I, you know, do internet
things. I lead with woodworking.
Woodworking, see? Yeah. The subject matter of the video.
It's something they can understand. And then if it goes further down that road, it'll end up at videos. But usually that's enough to kind of like, oh, okay. Do you make furniture and stuff? I mean, yeah, kind of.
What about you, Chad? I don't remember what your sort of stock answer to this is.
I usually always like default to entrepreneur, even though it's kind of cringy now, because that word has such a diluted meaning to it. But back in the day, it used to be, I kind of hate the word, but I've also become more comfortable with creator. I just create, and as opposed to
I thought you were going to say influencer.
I hated that from the get-go, and we were very particular. I would stop we'd have calls with big multi-billion-dollar brands, and they would throw, and I would just be like, we are not we are not influencers. If you want to go get some influencers, go on Instagram and get influencers. The larger reason why I ask is because YouTube kind of starts to become, well, Steve and I were talking about this earlier, where it's like YouTube kind of started back in the day where it was a platform to be able to go and be yourself, and that was the vessel to transport that out to the world. Now, because there's such an understanding of what it is, you kind of almost have your YouTube persona. So so I know you use Twitter quite a bit and you're active, and I still like Twitter simply because it feels like Chad Reynolds can have opinions and whatever, and that's a platform which is welcome for, if you're following me, you're following me. But now YouTube's kind of in this space where it's not as pure. It doesn't kind of seem as like, if I were to get, you know, the truth out of JJ, it's going to be through his videos, because the videos seem kind of more contoured and sculpted and purposeful. Do you feel that that's the case now in your content, when you're writing your content? Is there a whole bunch of other, is there 825,000 other people kind of in the room with you when you're thinking about what to do? Or do you still always try to like double down on like, this still just needs to be a one-way outlet?
Yeah, that's a good question. It actually kind of reminds me, like, I often think of making YouTube videos as being analogous to writing newspaper columns, right? So it's like, on Twitter is often sort of like the first draft of columns in many cases. And you see this with like lots of journalists and lots of people who are sort of like in the opinion journalism space, is that they're kind of beacon off. They're probably speaking a little too loosely. But, you know, they're also expressing their kind of like most unvarnished opinions, if I may use a woodworking metaphor, Steve, right? And it's like, and just as like when, I assume this is how wood works, right? When you actually do varnish things, you know, you make it nicer and more presentable, right? And it's sort of like, that's kind of how things work for column writing. You know, you kind of have half-formed opinions and you're kind of like just airing them, putting them up the flagpole to see who salutes, to add another metaphor.
You might say that they dovetail into the
bigger thing. Indeed. Maybe we can pile some more metaphors on this one. But anyway, like the point is that by the time I'm writing a column, I've sort of like refined my thoughts on a certain subject and sort of putting it out there as sort of the purest expression of my beliefs for public engagement. And I think that YouTube videos are the same way. Like, I might sort of say things on social media, I might say things on Twitter, but I would want to ultimately be judged primarily for the expression or for the opinions I express through my videos, because those will be, yes, the most varnished, the most refined, the most defensible expression of what I want to say to the world. And in fact, I sometimes feel like, Twitter is important for promoting my work at the Washington Post. And I often kind of feel like that's primarily why I stick with it, because I don't like sometimes the idea that my kind of more unvarnished opinions that I express on Twitter, just because I think some of the biases of the medium encourage you to sort of communicate that way, could in any way sort of conflict with the kind of image or messages I want to present at my best, which are the ones that I present through my YouTube video essays and so forth.
Do you still enjoy writing your column, or is it becoming more of a chore at this point when you have so much YouTube work to do?
Well, it would never be a chore, Steve. You know, this is such a not while Mr. Bezos is listening, of course not. But it's a very prestigious job, and I'm very grateful to have it. And it's like, you know, something I would have never imagined, I think, when I was young, I would ever have a job as sort of elite as to be a columnist for one of the greatest newspapers in the world. So no, I'm always trying to really appreciate it and treat it seriously. And I think, though, that it is something that's very valuable to me, because, you know, I work for the opinion section of the Washington Post, and I express sort of political opinions in a way that I don't want to express with my YouTube channel, right? Being an opinion journalist is important to me. You know, Canadian affairs are important to me. Canadian politics is very important to me. I still want to sort of be able to have a forum to sort of clearly sort of communicate my ideas and what I think should be done about the state of the country and so on and so forth. But I also don't want to run a political YouTube channel, because I think those are obnoxious in all sorts of ways. So I'm very glad that I have this one outlet to sort of continue to express, you know, to continue to sort of play out a certain side of my identity, which is political analyst and commentator. And then I have YouTube to, you know, communicate a different side of myself. And I often kind of feel like that's sort of something that more YouTubers should perhaps do, like consider having a sort of second racket, so to speak, you know, like you don't have to do everything through only one medium. Like, I guess I've been fortunate in my life because I've always been someone who works in multiple mediums at the same time. And I feel like that can be very, very liberating in a way. Like, you don't have to do everything in just one platform. And you can also sort of cultivate multiple audiences for different types of content through different types of platforms. I mean, I guess a lot of YouTubers do this through the second channel. Like, that's basically what you do, Steve, right? Like, you have your second channel, which is much more kind of like your opinion and your social commentary.
I just don't give a fuck about what is on there, and I don't care about people watching it. I don't know how many views. I'm not interested in any of that. It's just strictly an outlet for me to just
blur and this podcast as well sort of functions that
and
way.
Then the podcast is huge. I mean, it's so great to have that new outlet. It's just the kind of thing. It was like, God, I wish we'd started this years ago or something, you know. It was just because it was such a new fun thing to do. And again, it's the kind of thing that we don't have to obsess over numbers. We don't have to obsess over thumbnails and titles and all this crap that goes along with YouTube, which just literally drives me nuts. Chad and I were talking about this before the show, is the damn thumbnails.
Yeah, no, we still need to always worry about thumbnails and titles, Steve. That just never goes away.
But you've got those great thumbnails.
No, I don't.
I'm sure we've talked about that before.
Yes, you do.
Those yellow blocks with black letters.
Well, so, question. Right. Is yellow the best color to include on a thumbnail for text?
Well, I like yellow. It's one of my favorite colors. But it's also the case that yellow and black together are like the highest contrast and the most sort of like...
Like caution tape.
Yeah, precisely, right? Like, there's a reason why street signs are done in black and yellow. Like, there's something like... Studies have been done that prove that this is the sort of the thing that attracts the human eye the best. So that's why I do it. But it's not a miracle. You know, I still have a lot of flops despite how much yellow and black I cram in there. So,
well, it can't save every single video. However, you have a consistent look and you do also sometimes switch it up. So do you actually have a bit of a recipe? Because I know you include text. I know you sometimes include a picture of yourself. Mm-hmm. And when you're searching for a picture of yourself, what facial position works best for the people who watch JJ?
Oh, man. I really do this a lot more half-assed than I think it might appear to you, Chad. Like, it's literally...
Come on and you...
Well, it's like literally the very last thing that I do when I'm making a video is like right before I upload it, it's like, oh, crap, I got to make a thumbnail. So it's just like, throw it. Because I'm like one of these YouTubers, like, I don't know how common this is. I'm always very envious of people that like do their premieres, you know, and it's kind of like people often sort of say to me, like, why don't you do premieres? And it's like, geez Louise, it's like, I'm literally like working on the video until like the very second I press the upload button.
Panic.
Right?
Yeah. Press the button to launch it.
Yeah. But anyway, like, to answer the question, you know, a while ago I went to VidCon and I attended this sort of seminar on thumbnail design, and the guy seemed to have a lot of data behind it. He sort of said, you know, he crunched the numbers on, you know, thousands and thousands of thumbnails to see like which ones were the most, you know, quote unquote successful. And what he sort of said was that based on his data crunching, it's like darker videos, darker thumbnails, like the image should be sort of dark in dark colors, muted palette and that kind of thing. And that you should always have a face, and the face should be a certain proximity or a certain proportion of the overall frame, and that you should sort of limit the text as much as possible, like just try to have a few key words. And so like I try to do that as best as I can. You know, sometimes I'm just like running too up against the clock and I just kind of have to throw it together at the last second. But, you know, and then, like, the kind of faces I use are generally pretty generic. I kind of feel like I try to use a picture where I feel like I look broadly okay. Like, I don't do the like, what do they call it? Like, you know, like, I think the kids call it like the soy boy face, where you're like, you know, with your mouth all so
God, I hate that. I think Mr. Beast is really expert at that.
But it's like the funny thing though is and like this is something I thought about as well, where I've kind of come more to realize that the thumbnail in some ways just kind of has to match the spirit of the video. Like, I guess this is sort of like where the pejorative idea of clickbait comes from, because if you sort of like, it's clickbait, right? Like, you're luring people in, and just as like bait on a fishing line is sort of like the lure that gets you to bite the sharp, you know, jagged hook, right? Like, there's a kind of like, there's a bit of deception going on there, and that's why people resent it. And I think that the way that you have to compensate for clickbait is just having thumbnails that honestly match the content of the video that follows. And, you know, I watch a lot of these kind of high-minded sort of pseudo-intellectual video essays. You know, there's this kid called Emp Lemon who makes these really, I think, quite engaging video essays that I really like. But it's like, if you look at his thumbnails, they are so dry. You know, like he made one about Mount Everest, and which is really interesting, like the history of climbing Mount Everest. And it's just like this like kind of blurry kind of a photograph of like people climbing the mountain in black and white. And it's like, it's not engaging. There's no words. There's no big faces with puckered lips or anything like that. But it's like, it works on some level because it's kind of mellow and kind of intriguing and kind of mysterious. And like, that's what the video is. Like he delivers this long, thoughtful, information filled video essay about Mount Everest and the records of climbing it and, you know, the disputes over it and this kind of thing. So it's like, in some way, like the dry sort of mysterious and serious thumbnail matches a dry, serious, mysterious video, right? Whereas if he had done a sort of JJ style thumbnail with like big faces and yellow and black and colorful pictures and stuff like that, you know, maybe that would have been clickbait, right? Like clickbait is not necessarily just a way of sort of saying that the video sucks and that you shouldn't click on it. It can sometimes sort of say that just like, you know, there's a kind of disconnect between what viewers are led to believe the video might be like. And so in that kind of sense, it becomes a problem of effective communication and effective marketing. And so I sometimes do sort of think like, am I, you know, using a kind of Mr. Beast style thumbnail to sell a style of video that I make that is perhaps a little bit drier and more serious and shouldn't be marketing in such a sensationalistic kind of way?
Do you ever retroactively go back and check some of the and see if things are doing well or change a thumbnail or a title accordingly?
Yeah, all the time. I mean, I do that constantly. I've often sort of changed thumbnails or changed titles in an effort to make them more, honest or more genuine or more just like a more honest portrayal of what the video is like. And it's funny, I've actually, one of my most successful videos and one of the videos I'm most proud of is about sort of like the history of the religious right in America, which is a kind of overdone and kind of cliched topic. But I really wanted to make a really good video about that, and I feel I did, and it's been quite popular. And it's like, initially, my thumbnail for that video was kind of like a sort of dopey, you know, standard JJ thumbnail, you know, big yellow text. I don't even remember what it said. Probably said, like, religious right? Question mark? And they had, like, a big picture of, like, Trump's face and probably, like, my face and, like, you know, other sort of crosses and things decorating it in a kind of cluttered collage sort of way. But then I simplified that thumbnail. And only after I simplified it did that video really take off. I just found this like kind of like cheesy painting that someone had made of like Jesus Christ hugging Trump in the Oval Office. And I guess it's like a kind of like, it's a kind of sensationalistic image. It's kind of a weird image. A lot of people comment about the image specifically in the comments of that video. But it was just like a single stark image with no further decoration or editing. And in some ways, like, that kind of worked because, like, the kind of weirdness of that image matches kind of the weirdness of the story that I'm telling in the video. And this, it's like, it's a video that's not about me, so it makes sense to not really make my own sort of face front and center in it. So, I don't know, it's these sort of, like, subtle things. It's a real art, and it's one I really do not feel I've mastered.
We're starting to see also as people using, like, the clickbait quote, ironically or something, but it's still clickbait. I sent Chad this thumbnail of vidIQ.
Oh, yes.
They do. Okay, so it says, trick anyone into watching your videos. And I thought, this is just the state of YouTube right now. It's just how do you trick people into watching your videos? I bet you anything that this, and I didn't click through the video, but I'm pretty sure that if you click it, he's going to say, haha, you like the way I got you to watch this. Well, this is just what I'm, and so then we're going to get into this ironic phase of it where it's still clickbait, but they're saying, oh yeah, I acknowledge that it is. And then we may get into this post-ironic era and where does it all end? I don't know.
Yeah.
And what is YouTube going to recommend for you for the next 3 months of your life if you did click on that video is nonstop, you know, how to grow your channel. And
yeah. So. Yeah. I'm kind of disappointed now that I didn't go to VidCon knowing that you were there.
It wasn't this year. This was like VidCon 2019 or something. Yeah. It's the old
You gotta let us know if you go next year, because I'll go if you're there. I just don't want to go if I don't know anybody.
Yeah, same with me. Although when I went in 2019, I made a lot of YouTuber friends, which is nice, and some of my YouTuber buddies I've stayed connected with since I went there. But, you know, aside from sort of the socializing, there's just like a lot of sort of things where it's like you do it, and this is something like my mother would always say, like we're talking about like new experiences, like you do it so you can say you've done it, right? And so it's like I've done VidCon. Do I need to do it again? It's kind of like Vegas, right? Like I feel like I went to Vegas once, like, okay, I've done that, you know?
Yes, I can answer all the questions.
I tend to agree. Yeah, I think Vid 2018, I think, was the last time I was at VidCon. I remember thinking at the time that it was like, I'm not really getting anything out of this other than, like you say, meeting up with some people and that. I guess it's just a venue to meet up with other people.
I think you and I met for the very first time at VidCon, didn't we, Steve?
Yeah, we did.
Oh, my gosh. Wow. That's where all of this started. That's right.
Yeah. That was one of the early VidCons.
And that's when they had the different floors. I'm sure they still do have the different floors. And you were on the top floor because you got the really expensive ticket.
Hell yeah.
And I got the general admission ticket. So I was with the plebs.
You were slumming it down there on the show floor.
JJ, you were in Toronto for Bufferfest?
I was, yes. Something I had never heard of before. So,
what is Bufferfest?
Is this the film festival you're
talking about? Yeah. So it's like I was in...
Oh, good. I want to know about this.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's an interesting story. Like, so I was in Toronto anyway because I was doing more of my political agitation. There's a thing in Canada called Digital First Creators, which is a kind of, you know, organization that is sort of is lobbying on sort of political interest. You know, YouTube and TikTok and things are big supporters of it, and it's kind of pseudo-lobbying, pseudo-activism. And anyway, so I was giving a talk at a seminar about this, and then some of the people are like, oh, you guys staying for, are you staying for Bufferfest? And I'm like, I don't know what Bufferfest is, and they were like, oh, you gotta stay, it's really cool. So I stayed a couple more days in Toronto at Bufferfest, which was being co-hosted at the Fan Expo, which is like the big sort of comic entertainment sort of show that they have in Toronto once a year. But Bufferfest, it's basically like it's a film festival for YouTubers. So in the sense that there was a whole bunch of YouTubers from across Canada, the US, and a bunch from England as well. And they were basically debuting their latest video, which was usually like a fairly epic video that they've been working on for a while, in a kind of theater style setting. So we would all go and we'd sit in an auditorium and then we'd watch, you know, a couple hours of YouTube videos from a bunch of different creators. Every night it was kind of a different theme. So there was like the short film sort of night, which was kind of miscellaneous, and then there was like the kind of like the documentary style ones, and then there was like the comedy ones, and there were some animation ones as well that were sprinkled in there as well. I think there's going to be a separate category for animation in the future. And then at the end of each video, we were encouraged to use our phones and vote for which video we liked, or give it a rating out of 10 stars or something, and say if we thought the, you know, what impressed you the most? Was it the editing? Was it the scripting? You know, was it the sound design or whatever? And then on the final night, they had a big sort of Oscar-style gala in which we all wore our fancy clothes and did the red carpet walk and all of that.
Nice.
And then you sort of sit in the auditorium and then they announce the winners based on the audience voting, which I think is kind of how film festivals work as well, right? Like that you vote for your top picks of the festival. And it was cool. The weird thing about it, though, is that it was like the you might be like wondering, well, who gets to show their videos at this festival? And that is still like quite unclear to me. From what I understand, it was invite only. So I guess it wasn't like a film festival in the sense that you submit your videos and they say yay or nay. But I think the organizers of the festival, and I'm also like not super clear to what degree YouTube is running this, or if YouTube kind of has an arm's length relationship with it, that is still a bit ambiguous to me. But in any case, most of the people I spoke to said that, like, no, they were there because they were invited by the film festival to be there. They didn't consciously submit their own content to it. And so what this meant was that some of the, when we got to awards night, some of the competitions were really, like, unusual in the sense that, like, the guys that won for best comedy was this channel called Neat Cool OK, which is a tiny channel, less than 400 subscribers. They made a really hilarious video, really high production quality and all the rest of it. It's like, you know, five guys out of Toronto or something who are just getting started. And they won Best Comedy, and they beat, among other people, Daniel Thrasher, who is like this real big YouTube comedy guy from LA who has like over 3 million subscribers. So, and it was all just sort of based on the audience votes. So you can sort of say there's something kind of fundamentally democratic about this. But it's, I don't know, it was just a little kind of curious at the eclectic nature of these videos that you'd be watching when you'd be sitting down that evening. And, you know, if I'm going to be blunt here, there was a fair bit of diversity in terms of quality as well. You know, you did get some stuff that was really, really impressive, and then some stuff that was obviously very amateurish from a very amateurish channel. But, you know, maybe that's part of the kind of the interesting nature of this sort of thing.
That sounds really cool. I love that idea of bringing these together into one film festival. Do you watch Joel Haver? Are you familiar with Joel?
I know
Haver's
of him. I'm not
videos?
Very familiar.
So he has been making, you know, short films, even features, independent features for a while now. And he just started his second channel. Everybody has to have a second channel, but his is just about film and independent film and just talking about things like film festivals. And I find it real fascinating to hear his views on what period of time we're in right now, where the big budget studio productions are just so irrelevant, especially to younger people. It means nothing to them if a movie has a $50 million budget when, you know, $30 million went to Robert Downey Jr. or whatever, but you can make a video literally with no budget that can be just as entertaining, just as good, and anybody can do it. I think it's amazing time we're in. And I think we're in this sea change right now. Really within the last decade, this has become possible for anybody to have access to the tools and distribution that weren't there before.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And you sort of wonder, like, if things like Bufferfest are kind of like embryonic versions of things that are going to become more sort of culturally significant events in sort of the calendar as the years go on, right? Because, you know, people want to be celebrated, people want to be awarded, and people, I think the public kind of has a legitimate desire to sort of want to be told what is the new big thing, you know, who deserves celebration. Like this is, you know, it's easy to be sort of cynical about award shows like the Grammys or the Oscars or whatever, but they do have like a legitimate sort of promotional quality to them as well. They, you know, in theory, you kind of have an expert class that is kind of sorting what is the creme de la creme of entertainment content that is being produced in any given year in our society. And I think something like I wouldn't fail to recommend any of the winners of Bufferfest. I think they all produced really good videos that are all probably worth watching on some level, just to kind of get a sense of really like some of the high production quality content, video content that is being made by, you know, what are in theory amateur YouTubers. Although in theory, that's, you know, that's also becoming kind of a blurry category, because at the end of some of these videos that we watched, you see this like long sort of scrolling credits list. You know, they literally had like gaffers and, you know, these kinds of things that you associate with like Hollywood
key grips,
you know, right? Exactly. Yeah. Right. So what is an amateur? What is a professional? It's all very hazy.
But I think it's cool that a film with only 400 subscribers or a YouTube channel, you know, won that.
Yeah.
Because I think so often we are in this mindset that the quality of a piece of art is determined by how many people bought it or how many views it's had. And, you know, we look at like the box office returns of a movie over the past weekend, and it's like, oh, it made $40 million. It wasn't a success because they were expecting to make $80 million. Or a channel that produces videos on YouTube isn't probably relevant because it only has 400 subscribers.
Yes.
You know, all of these notions have nothing to do with the art that's being made.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that, you know, when it happens in a kind of Hollywood context, you know, when a small time film or a small time director wins, you know, Best Picture or whatever, we view that as something kind of democratic in a way, like something that's very validating about the sort of the truly meritocratic nature of our culture. And I think that I think that it is kind of weird that YouTube in some ways has kind of drifted from that. I guess it's not weird. It's just a predictable outcome of the nature of the medium that is so numbers focused. But I think that if we want to have a sort of way to sort of celebrate the quality of work that the site produces independent of the numbers metric, it's important to have things like Buffer Festival that can just be an unapologetic celebration of quality above anything else.
It's great to see that there's also still a lot of creators out there that are interested in creating longer form, especially right now with the popularity of TikTok and just short form content and YouTube's huge focus on just short, disposable 15-second content to whatever. And you mentioned earlier Amp Lemon, or there's Patrick CC, or there's Sunny V2. And there's now coming out of this short form content kind of popularity is this renewed interest in like more kind of video essays and like whatnot. And the quality of these pieces are the content is becoming so well done that me and Melissa will sit and opt to watch a few video essays as opposed to watching, you know, a movie or trying to find something on Netflix. And yeah. Stuff like Bufferfest is only going to be shining a light on this kind of more traditional longer form content. Did they have like super short form content as well, or is it?
Yeah, it was all generally pretty long. I mean, there was like, you know, in the comedy category, there was a couple that were just maybe like, you know, 3 minutes or under. There was one that was actually like 15 seconds long, but like that was kind of like, it was done by the Cyanide and Happiness, which is a sort of like animated sort of thing.
You only need 15 seconds.
Yeah, but it's like that was obviously very much the exception to the rule. Some were actually really quite long, like, you know, like over 45 minutes or something like that, which was interesting. Although it is kind of interesting too, though, because, you know, we can think of content like the three of us make on some level, which is all kind of like broadly sort of educational and in some ways like just kind of about communicating information in a somewhat sort of transactional way. And I kind of feel like I would have liked to have had a category celebrating that as well, because like there's good and bad ways to do that. And sort of I think that one of the challenges is that if things like Bufferfest are going to become sort of more institutionalized, you don't want to go down the path of only celebrating content that rises to the level of like cinematic kind of content, right? Because right. I think that like, you know, it's difficult to communicate useful educational information in a sort of clear and helpful way. And I think that there's so many different creators on YouTube that are excelling communicating all sorts of different types of content to their audience.
What would you call this kind of form? And for instance, like what you do, even in my intro and just trying to explain to people your channel, I don't know what category you would put that in. There needs to be almost a new...
Well, it is. It's almost like the YouTuber category, because it almost implies, because it is a YouTube video, it has this certain kind of...
Because it's not vlogging.
No.
You don't vlog. I think people have an idea of what that is. But you're not really focused on one or two topics in general. It's kind of a wide range of things you talk about. But it's the method of delivery that you have and the presentation that seems to be its own style or category of video.
Yeah, it's hard to say. Like I often kind of, this kind of goes back to your question, Chad. Like if we talk about like, how do I introduce myself? Like how do I introduce myself to the public is one question, but also like, how do I introduce myself to other YouTubers is an interesting thing to consider as well, right? So it's like...
And I wouldn't call you a video essayist.
Yeah, and
either.
That's...
Yeah. Because video essay presumes a kind of seriousness and I think length and you know, just... I make weekly videos, right, which sort of makes the content a little bit lighter, I think, by nature. So I don't know, like when I meet other YouTubers who don't know me, I sort of feel like I kind of say, well, I sort of do like broadly educational content, because I like to think that like you watch my videos and you always learn something, right? Like that's always the goal, is that I'm helping teach. Sometimes I do videos that are a little bit more analytical, but even that I think kind of falls into a broadly sort of educational column. So I don't know. But then when you say educational like that, it would be like, would the three of us be in the same category for that? Because like you're teaching stuff, right?
Yeah, there's a whole responsibility associated with it. And it's not like it's educational. And we've been nominated for Webbies and Streamy Awards in the past, and they have the same thing. Like, we're going up against Veritasium and like all the science shows and all the educational shows. Like, and this massive component, and a lot of older channels would fall into this category. But it's like, what do you call them? It's disingenuous to say video essays, because essay just sounds like it's a school thing that you have to do, as opposed to like a deep dive on a subject that I'm very much interested in. But it sounds a lot more dry sandwiches when you say it's a video essay. And the reason, part of the reason why this conversation was brought up, because I noticed your actual videos are a lot longer than they were even a little while ago. So, for someone who has had so much success out of the short form content, was that a deliberate thing to be like, hey, I want to start kind of producing more or saying more, or is it just circumstance?
I don't know. I feel like I'm kind of like, I'm sort of failing to learn one of the great lessons of journalism and column writing in particular, which is that, you know, not every column you write has to express every thought you've ever had on a topic, right? And I feel like that was a piece of advice that I was given once, and it has always stuck with me. And whenever I deal with younger writers, I always tell them that, because I think that younger writers, particularly sort of who are used to writing for blogs and things where there's no word count limit, they, you know, if they're writing something about, you know, something to do with politics or whatever, they'll just go on this like long, like 3,000 word, you know, ramble where they express just every idea that they've ever had. And you can't do that when you're writing for a newspaper like I do, because it literally just won't fit on the page if you go too long. That's why you have to have word counts. So, but in YouTube, I think that sometimes the temptation is too strong to just express every thought you've ever had on a topic. And I think that I sometimes, like, shorts have been good for me because they've been very disciplining, right? Like, that they've forced me to really sort of be economical with my words and what is the core of what I need to communicate, and then sort of cut out all of the excess, like just really sort of focus on the essence of a little educational lesson or little, you know, teaching exercise or whatever, right? But then with the longer videos, maybe I in some way feel more enabled to just go on and on and on and on and on, because I know that, you know, unlike shorts, if I go over a sort of set, you know, second count, let alone minute count, I won't be punished for it. The video won't, you know, fail to, in theory, it won't fail to be any more popular. I mean, so I don't know. I feel like I just maybe need to be a little bit more self-disciplined. And I feel like maybe I'm approaching topics in some of my recent videos that are a little too open-ended and just don't have clear kind of, you know, guidelines around them to sort of like rein me in or keep me. It's why, you know, I've started doing a lot of these videos where it's just like lists of things, and I kind of like go through a list and I analyze them. And the way I sort of try to keep myself disciplined as far as that goes is I try to always find someone else's list to use. So it's like, okay, like here's somebody's list of toys and there's like 10. So like I can't go beyond 10. Whereas if it was just like JJ's list of the most important toys, it might be like 20. And then the video is like over an hour long and I'm editing it and like, you know, again, like right up until the very last second of posting it, which is also late.
I think you keep your videos pretty concise for the most part. I would say they're probably in the 15, 20, 25 minute range. Most of them are in there. And I just find that you've got really good pacing on those. They're entertaining. But I do want to thank you for that bit of advice. I remember you said that before about you don't need to express every thought. And this came true recently for me when, I don't know if you remember, like a year ago, I was talking about making this documentary I wanted to make about the history of YouTube woodworking and how it's, you know, changed. And I shot some interviews. This was a year ago, and I got obsessed with overwhelmed. How am I going to get all of this stuff in? I don't have enough people in there. I need to get this guy. And I didn't do anything for a year. So I shelved it. And then just a few weeks ago, I thought, you know, I'm going to take a look at that again, totally fresh eyes. And I remembered what you said is you don't have to include every thought in there. And I took that to heart and I thought, yeah, you're right. I don't have to include every person who's made a woodworking video. I don't have to have every interview. And just because I interviewed somebody for an hour doesn't mean I have to include any specific amount of that. I can take out, you know, maybe under a minute is really the good stuff in there. And it all worked out. Now I've got a 15 minute video which I think is really good. Nobody's going to watch it because it's not a topic they're interested in. But I loved it, and I think it's fantastic. And I'm releasing it Friday. Chad and I were talking about thumbnails for this damn thing too.
But very nice.
Anyway, so yeah, I think that is such good advice. It is so tempting to think that you have to include everything you know,
yeah,
and want to express on a topic. And I think it's good just to leave it be.
That's good. I'm excited to see it. I think 15 minutes sounds like the perfect length for communicating. I think most things can be communicated in about 15 minutes, honestly.
So what was it like going to Canadian Congress? Is that what it was you went to and testified about this bill, the C-11? Is that
Bill C-11, yeah.
Was it scary talking to them?
Not really. I mean, but that's because, like, you know, I've been a political journalist for a long time, so, like, I've spent a lot of time around politicians.
They were kind of snotty too.
Well, yeah, I mean, like, so, like, basically, I was testifying at a committee of the House of Commons, which is the lower elected chamber of the Canadian Parliament. Canada is such a wonderful democracy that we have a whole chamber of the Parliament that's not even elected, so we have to, like, specify. I was testifying to the elected chamber, and, you know, and, like, during my testimony at the committee, you know, they cross-examined me because, you know, it's politics, and it's like I'm associated with a certain faction in domestic Canadian politics. And
briefly explain what this bill is.
Yeah. So, you know, this is kind of complicated history to get into.
You have 30 seconds.
All right,
go.
Well, it's sort of like, you know, Canada has always been defined by anxiety about being too much like the United States. And for at least like 70 years or so, the consensus has been that the Canadian government has an obligation to regulate the media that Canadians consume in order to prevent them from consuming too much American media and thus losing the essence of what this country is supposed to be all about, right? Traditionally, the Canadian government has regulated television and radio in various ways. You know, they make quotas of how much Canadian, what they call Canadian content, has to be shown on the radio or on the television. And, you know, there's this whole, like, preposterous, in my opinion, sort of certification process that you have to go through in order to get your work certified as Canadian, to be a certifiable Canadian.
Canadian enough
to be promoted in various ways. And now the Trudeau administration has sort of said that they want to bring a similar regulatory regime to the internet, specifically to platforms like YouTube and TikTok, and then also the big things like Netflix and Disney Plus and so forth, which is to sort of say that they want to bring in a regulatory regime. And a lot of this is still kind of ambiguous for reasons that are even more complicated to explain. But basically, the goal is that there will be some sort of regulatory framework in which the big sort of streaming tech companies, including YouTube, will be obligated to promote, you know, quote unquote, good Canadian content to Canadian audiences in order to sort of build up the, you know, cultural integrity of this country. The line that the Minister of Canadian Heritage, which is an office we have in this country, has used is that we need to do this to protect Canada's, quote, cultural sovereignty, right? Like the idea that, like, the cultural sovereignty of this country is being eroded by Canadians watching too many dirty foreign videos when they should be watching good character building patriotic Canadian videos. And so how this is going to play out is still a bit ambiguous, as I said, because of course in the Canadian political system, a lot of times, you know, the parliament passes laws that do very little but grant regulatory authority to some other bureaucratic entity that actually makes the rules.
It would put the burden on YouTube to provide that sort of technology to screen or something.
Which is not, it's not impossible to imagine. Like, people sometimes sort of say, like, oh, well, this could never happen in practice. But it does happen in practice right now, right? Like, we know that YouTube has been obligated by the U.S. Congress to, you know, limit the sort of videos that can be shown to children, and that if you make, you know, we all have to click that little button that says, you know, this is not for kids. And, you know, if you talk to, as you guys have, you know, you talk to creators who make content for children because of U.S. law, you know, they have to play by completely different rules, and that they operate in a completely sort of different YouTube space in terms of their ability to advertise or engage with content or even view their own analytics, right? Because, you know, the U.S. government has dictated that, you know, for the betterment of children and so forth, you know, YouTube has an obligation to prevent kids from seeing certain types of content and so on and so forth. And we, you know, we already have the same sort of regulatory regime when it comes to stuff like, you know, gore and sex and violence and so forth. This is not a legal obligation, but YouTube obviously has set up an infrastructure in order to screen content based on whether or not it hits those kind of marks. You know, we all have to sort of check the boxes and say, does this content have sex or nudity or, you know, shocking content or whatever? And then the YouTube algorithm sort of sorts the content accordingly. And, you know, this obviously appeases advertisers as well. So it's not impossible to imagine that there could be some sort of self-certification process that Canadian YouTubers could have to go through in the future. They would have to verify, you know, does my video contain Canadian settings, Canadian themes? Were Canadians involved in the editing process? You know, do I speak one of Canada's two official languages? You know, this kind of stuff. And then in theory,
sounds like that'd be easier to game that than the checkbox for nudity.
I think so. But at the same time, there would also presumably be some sort of auditor class, as there is right now, who would sort of screen to make sure that you're not lying about, you know, how much Canadian content is in your video. I don't know. It's ludicrous, right? And like there's this kind of, and there's like criticism of this bill comes in many different directions. And some people sort of say, like, well, is this just going to be a sort of giveaway to sort of like the establishment mainstream media channels in Canada, you know, who, of course, have YouTube channels as well, you know, like the big Canadian television networks, mm-hmm. like is ultimately those are going to be the only channels that will be unambiguously able to be certifiably Canadian because their credentials and their bona fides are so beyond dispute, right? Whereas the rest of us will all be kind of like struggling and thrashing about to understand this crazy new Canadian algorithm.
Are these the same kind of levers and buttons that are being used for Netflix right now? Because I do know that we have the quote-unquote Canadian Netflix. I know people who use the VPN things and they can get American, the dirty foreign Netflix.
Yeah.
So is that actually like, or is this Canadian content in that, or is that just like, no, Netflix actually has differing platforms for like each country?
Yeah, like with things like Netflix, it's much more about like property rights or IP rights, right? So it's like Canada, because it's a different country, it has you know, sort of a different you know, like the Canadian broadcasters have different legal arrangements with the American, you know, studios and so forth, right? So it's like Canadian Netflix might have to jump through different legal holes to be a lawful distributor of certain movies or TV shows or whatever, because some Canadian company might have the broadcasting rights to do that, right? And then that's why, you know, I'm sure, I don't know if you do this, Chad, but like, you know, Crave, right? Which is like some sort of weird Canadian streaming service that Americans are unaware of. But like Crave only exists because there's just like a lot of big American studios and TV series and things like that that have sort of pre-existing relationships with Canadian distributors. So there has to be like some sort of Canadian streaming service to legally broadcast these things. And Netflix can't, you know, so that's why the viewing experience is different. But that's very different than sort of the regime that would come to YouTube, which is much more about analyzing things based on content, right? It's the idea of like promoting good Canadian content to Canadian audiences as determined by some sort of government assessment of what is good Canadian content.
So what is your argument, base argument against this bill?
I mean, I just kind of think that, you know, I'm working on a video right now where I talk about the theory of descriptivism versus prescriptivism as sort of a theory of culture. And like one is sort of like, should culture be dictated from the top down or the bottom up, right? And so my philosophy has always been that I don't think government should be in the business of telling people what they should watch for patriotic reasons. Like, I just do not think it is the government's job to attempt to build or construct the culture of a nation in this way, particularly when it comes to something like what entertainment the people of that country consume. You know, I think Canadian culture is determined by what Canadians want to make and what Canadians want to watch, and whether that's foreign content, domestic content, whether the content includes Canadian, explicitly Canadian themes, or whether it includes sort of, you know, I don't mean to say this pejoratively, Chad, but like, you know, your content, for example, like you're a Canadian content creator, but you make like, you know, more quote unquote, sort of like more generic content, right? Like your content is universally accessible and relevant. And that's good. Like, to me, that's as much Canadian content as anything else, right? Like, So I just don't think the government should be in the business of telling people what sort of content to make, or like what kind of content makes you a better Canadian by consuming. Like I'm just, you know, maybe I'm, and I said this during my parliamentary testimony, like I'm a bit of a free market kind of guy when it comes to this kind of thing. I think stuff should rise or fail based on its popularity with the audience. And as we said at the beginning of the show as well, like there is no, like maybe there's an argument in the government's mind that, you know, the cultural sovereignty of this country is being threatened and we need this kind of heavy-handed sort of regulation to protect our integrity as a nation in some way. But I definitely think there's no defensible argument for the other half of what the government has often said, which is that this needs to be done because Canadian content creators need a helping hand. I think that there's tons and tons of evidence to suggest that Canadian content creators on YouTube and other social media platforms have been tremendously successful because Canadians are talented people who have made good quality content that's relevant and interesting to a global audience and don't really need assistance to thrive.
Do you think the designers of this bill and the people supporting it just have a fundamental misunderstanding of new media and YouTube and how it works?
Yeah, I think so. And I mean, and like, there's like a lot of, you know, there is a lot of complexity to this, and there's questions about like, well, who's really the driving force behind this and why, and who is the government actually listening to? You know, as I said before, you know, Canadian television and radio have to jump through a lot of hoops that the government has already sort of set up. You know, they have to release Canadian content and so forth. And so I think that the old sort of media companies in Canada are not unjustly resentful of new media like YouTube that doesn't have to play by the same regulatory rules. You know, like they don't like that the old media companies, the Canadian television companies, don't like, for example, the idea that they have to devote, I think it's something like 50% of prime time to showing Canadian television shows that Canadians often just do not want to watch. So they look at this and they sort of say, like, this isn't fair. Government, you know, level the playing field here. Make them play by the same rules that we have to. And, you know, because these are big entrenched media organizations and because Canada's a relatively sort of small country, you know, these kind of things have a lot of pull on the government. When the government comes to drafting legislation, you know, when I was testifying at the committee, the other witnesses were all representatives of the big media companies and they were all super gung-ho for this bill. I was the lone voice of dissent. So, and then there's like even a more sort of cynical sort of side of it as well, is that there's like sort of taxation kind of obligations. You know, there's a sense that YouTube is not paying its fair share of tax, and that matters because the Canadian government, through the Heritage Ministry, sort of takes money that it taxes from the large media companies and then distributes it to smaller content creators that it thinks are sort of serving the national interest in some way. So there's a sense that, like, again, like YouTube doesn't have to play by that rule that the other media companies kind of like resentfully are obligated to.
Do you think your testimony had any effect on anyone there, or did everybody already had their minds set on which way they were going to vote on this or whatever? And by the way, anybody listening to this, you can watch your full testimony on your channel.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting because it's like it is easy to be sort of cynical about these kinds of things and to think that, you know, you're just blowing in the wind and all this kind of stuff is a fait accompli and all that. But, you know, my testimony got 500,000 views, which I think is not bad for testimony at a Canadian parliamentary committee. Right?
I love that you started out with hello friends.
Yes, I had to do that, right? Even when I'm testifying at the Canadian Parliament, I'm thinking like, is this going to be good content? You know, so
still a YouTuber.
Yes. But it's like, but the interesting thing is that I have found that Canadians of the left, right, and center are pretty unanimously opposed to this legislation. Like, I do not find a lot of people that are willing to defend it in public or elsewhere. Other YouTubers who have made videos on it have all been unanimously critical of it. And when I'm, you know, I get recognized a fair bit when I'm out and about in public, and almost always now people lead with Bill C-11 in terms of what they want to talk to
that's
me about,
good.
Right? So it's like, sometimes that's even what they recognize me for. It's like, oh, you're the C-11 guy, you know, keep fighting the good fight, man, and this kind of stuff, right? And so I'm happy about it. But, you know, the elected half of the Canadian Parliament has already voted to approve this legislation. It is now before the unelected half of the Canadian Parliament, which is the Senate of Canada, which is not known for being a particularly responsive chamber. I think kind of justly so, since it's not elected. I mean, what basis do they have to reject legislation passed by Canada's elected representatives? But, you know, the last kind of hope is that we can persuade the senators to at the very least water down a bill that they might be otherwise inclined to rubber stamp. So I'm hoping to go back to Ottawa again in the next couple of weeks and do more testimony to make my case to a different set of politicians.
Your buddy's running for mayor of Ottawa, isn't he?
Yeah, my buddy
Gregory
Guevara is his.
Is he as weird as he comes across in his videos? His videos are like just existential.
Greg is a great kid. Like, I really like him a lot. I think he's a really impressive, really creative, really artistic mind. And I think a great creator as well, like a great artist, a great entertainer. And I really, I think that what he's doing now with his candidacy as for mayor of Ottawa is like a great sort of like Andy Kaufman-esque kind of like performance piece, right?
Yeah. And it's hilarious.
It is hilarious. And I think he's very conscious of this. Like it's a very sort of like fun intersection between like the online world and the real world and the idea of like bringing a character like his Dreg character like into the world of reality and like what that would be like. And it's fun, like he goes to these debates and stuff and you kind of see the way the serious straight-laced politicians, like they don't know what to make of him.
It was so funny. It was just like, oh, they did not understand what was happening.
Yeah, it's wonderful. I love to see it, as the kids say, and I hope he does well.
I do too. That'd be great if he won. I doubt it though.
You never know. Stranger things have happened, and I mean, Canadian politics is pretty sclerotic and pretty staid, so it can be. You know, don't forget that this is the same country that elected Rob Ford as mayor of Toronto, right?
It's a very good point.
JJ, it's great having you on the show again. It's always great talking to you. I think that we could probably go on for at least another hour here, so we're going to have to have you back on again and just keep doing this from time to time. I enjoy it a lot.
I enjoy it a lot, too. You guys are great hosts, and you make a great podcast, so I love to be on.